afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Folks, one of my favorite expressions is semper gumby, which means always flexible. Hang in there. We're going to be making some rearrangements. We are going to start where we plan to start, which is I'm opening a work session on the Department of Administrative Services Compensation Planning Report. Mr. Turpening.
Thank you, Chair Stainer Hayward, members of the committee. ORS 291.371 requires the Department of Administrative Services to report on implementation of compensation plan changes and position allocations, and they are here to do so.
Thank you. Mr. Naughton, Ms. Syke.
Chair Stainer Hayward, members of the subcommittee, I'm George Naughton, the Chief Financial Officer for the State of Oregon. With me is Madeline Zeik, the Chief Human Resource Officer. We're going to make this actually fairly quick. We're required to report before we make compensation plan adjustments to you. The ones in front of you today, which Ms. Zeik will walk through very quickly, are very, very small compared to what you've seen before. I think we're really only talking about 31 people that are touched by this, so this is very, very small in the big scheme. With that, Ms. Zeik, if you could walk them through.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stainer Hayward, members of the committee. As George Naughton said, I'm Madeline Zeik. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer for the state. There are three items that I wanted to report on today. The first is the implementation of a classification change at the Oregon State Treasury. That's five individuals that will be in a new classification. The second is a selective salary adjustment for the administrative law judge within the Employment Department, and that's one individual position that will be impacted by that. And the third is a contract that we have settled with the State Teacher State Teacher Education Association for compensation plans and insurance, which is similar to the others that we have negotiated with our larger units, and there are 26 members that are impacted by that. And with that, unless there are any questions, that was all I had for you today.
Wonderful. Les, if you want to go next, you're Les. Questions for the Ms. Zeik or Mr. Naughton? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Naughton. This once again seems to raise compensation to employees. That's what reclassifications usually do. Could you put on the record what the average compensation for an Oregon State employee is and what the mean compensation is?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, Senator Whitsitt and I have had some time talking about what is the average and median salaries for state employees. Average base rate for state employees in 2015 was about $4,669 based on our payroll system is the average salary for state employees on a monthly basis. The median was about $4,423.
That include total compensation?
That is base pay. That is not inclusive of other payroll expenses.
And including payroll expenses?
Members of the subcommittee, Senator Whitsitt, we did not total it up by total OPE. We've got the factors, we can provide that, but we did not do it as an average for all of that, inclusive of total comp.
Okay. Follow up. Would $191,000 average, or would $91,000 average and about an $87 mean be right in the ballpark?
Members of the Chair, Senator Stainer Hayward, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt, right off the top of my head, running those kind of numbers, I'm not sure I could give you an accurate number. My brain is not that quick. We can certainly calculate that for you and get it to you, though.
Would you make it available, Stickman? Thank you.
Any other questions? CFO, you have anything to add to this conversation?
Good afternoon, Chair Stainer Hayward, members of the committee, Patrick Heath from the Chief Financial Office. We recommend acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you. Mr.
Turpin. Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, I'd move that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves that we acknowledge receipt of the report. Is there any discussion of the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? If not, so moved. Thank you very much. We need carrier control for this. Anybody want to volunteer?
I do that.
You
sure.
Do it?
Okay.
Senator Whitsitt? Sure. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to close the work session on the Department of Administrative Services and open a work session on Senate Bill 1569. Ms. McHugh.
Good afternoon. Senate Bill 1569 establishes the Joint Legislative Policy and Research Committee. The committee will appoint a legislative policy and research director who is authorized to hire staff and fulfill duties as specified, which include conducting research, facilitating policy development, providing assistance and advice, and supervising committee staff for the legislature. Some of these duties are currently assigned to the Legislative Administration Committee, which will no longer be responsible for those duties. Current staff and funds assigned to LAC for such work will be transferred to the new office. As such, LAC funding and staffing levels will be reduced. Funding and position authority, in addition to what will be transferred, will be needed to accommodate the requirements of the measure, which is effective July 1st, 2017.
Thank you. Senator Boquist, welcome.
Thank you, Madam and Sir Co-Chairs. I am Senator Brian Boquist, District 12, and I'm actually in here in a strange capacity representing the Senate President. So I hope Senator Wissett doesn't pass out in his chair on the left-hand side. To give you a little bit of history, this is a this is actually fairly simple and straightforward in terms of ways and means. This bill came through the Rules Committee. However, there is funding in the your present budget from you folks in Joint Ways and Means who do your voodoo down here. And that has to be attached to this. So it's actually not a new appropriation. I do want to give you a little bit of history about this bill. What it does is create the Legislative Policy and Research Committee. Actually, this goes back to the constitutional change for annual sessions, and we're all having fun for 35 days, right? Right? So think of that, okay? Right. I was a no vote, so therefore the Senate President appointed me on every successive work group and committee that had to do with annual sessions. And one of the very first things that came up was the fact that pardon my French here from our colleagues back here, that the executive branch is consistently hoodwinking all of us weekend warriors over here in the legislative branch. And so therefore what we needed was a full-time, nonpartisan, bipartisan, non-D, non-R research function so that on key major issues that we could be able to outmaneuver our colleagues in the executive branch. So I went from place to place to place, and along the way I picked up the good Senator Johnson, the good representative to my left, the good Senator Wittsett, and after three full sessions of doing this, at some point of us telling us that we really needed to have a nonpartisan, bipartisan, equal D's and R's, equal chamber oversight over the top of research and if not committee services, that they didn't believe us. So we spent last session a couple $100,000 to bring consultants in to tell the good representative to my left and Senator Wittsett and Senator Johnson that we really needed to possibly do this another way, and the net result is absolutely where we started 6 years ago, three sessions ago, which is where we are today, which is we would like all members across the board is to have a research function and have it overseen in a committee services that we can all claim is nonpartisan, bipartisan, equal D's, equal R's. Now, the implementation rules of who gets to make the motion first, whose priority comes second, is all yet to sort of be determined because, I don't know, somewhere in this report we came to the conclusions that a lot of us like this and a lot of us like that, but the first step in this whole process is before you right now, which is that is we're going to, the proposal you have is to basically make a LFO, LRO, and now instead of having committee services, it will be its own branch. And it will be overseen by a committee that's equal D's and equal R's. And from there, we'll food fight it out and figure out how to implement the rest of this stuff. So that's sort of where we are after 6 years. And again, it's here because there was money put in the last appropriation to do this, to just go forward. Now, I spoke twice as long as I did last time, actually half as much. So therefore, I'm going to give the good representative to my left, and I can switch to right if you want me to point out her observations over the last 2 years of this fine consulting group that we did that brought this to you.
Thank you, Senator. Takes my breath away. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. Hello, colleagues. Indeed, it's like Back to the Future, maybe. There was some discussion for some number of months, maybe too many months, what if there should be an independent agency? Well, what do you mean? Start up some independent group in some other building, and then we're paying staff, and we're paying rent, and we're hiring a director, and who gives this thing instructions? And all of a sudden, we're over $4 million, I think, a biennium, and it's like, it's real big, and how would you manage it? And whoa, wait, that's not That's not necessarily the best way to start this. The proposal that you have in front of us here, I believe, is showing the very best of an approach, which is incremental change. Instead of leaping into the great unknown and spending a lot of money in, at the same time, with something like an independent policy commission, this is a very careful, incremental approach to increase professional capacity in the legislative branch. What we would hope to do is increase capacity to allow the staff to specialize in topic areas similar to the capacity that we have in Legislative Revenue Office and Legislative Fiscal Office. They could specialize in areas, for example, this is not directive, but for example, instead of having staff come and go, you ramp up for a session and then some of the staff go away, you could specialize and have staff who really knew the subject area, transportation, human services, natural resources, and so on. In addition to being able to respond to requests for information, do some research, what are other states doing, we certainly believed that instead of providing a recommendation, no, that's not what we would want from a, as you have pointed out, bicameral, bipartisan, I like to call it the quadrilateral approach to managing this. No, we just want ideas. We want research, we want information, and maybe options, a set of options to consider. We're not asking for a recommendation. It also, now this is just me as one person, it occurs to me we probably, speaking of the legislative branch versus the executive branch, could benefit from occasionally asking for information. You know that bill we passed? How's it going? Is the agency implementing it yet? How's that rulemaking authority going? Sometimes we hear from constituents that, whoa, this thing is really going sideways. This is not exactly what we thought we intended when we passed that bill. So it should provide us the nonpartisan or bipartisan approach to providing more research capacity to help the legislative branch in either retrospectively seeing how it's going with what we've already implemented or give us some options and some research going into the future. So I really hope that you look on this favorably and pass it out of this committee.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Johnson.
Well, I appreciate the presentation. I sat through I don't know how many of those meetings that led to the Athena report, and the fact that there was an acquiescence to make this an equal number of R's and an equal number of D's satisfied a number of my concerns. I still think working out the devil in the details, the gatekeeper, who decides how to avoid turning this office into the research arm for specific legislators, we've got an awfully long way to go to work out the rules of the road. But I absolutely agree that the legislature needs more depth so that we can dig into some of these subjects that heretofore we have had to rely on the veracity and the completeness of the executive branch, which is sometimes regrettably spun. And this gives us the tools to fight back, at least with our own independent research. But for me, the threshold issue was the equal number of R's and equal number of D's. And we will have to be vigilant as we figure out the details. But I'm thrilled that those of you close to this were able to persuade the powers that if this were not an equal number, this, for many of us, was a non-starter.
Representative Frederick, do you have a question too, Senator Whitsitt? Representative Frederick, Senator Whitsitt, Representative Comp.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really pleased with this. I'm really pleased to see this take place. I am curious. I've been spending a lot of time looking at the research documents coming out of Washington State because their center up there is extraordinary. They don't do that much. They only do one or two issues a year. I think it's one or two issues a session, but it's comprehensive and it has helped them do quite a bit. I'm sure you looked at their system. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious about why you decided to go with this system, which is nonpartisan, bipartisan. Theirs appears to be nonpartisan in many ways because of the way that they've handled the research.
Money.
Ha! Okay.
If you look at the report that came out from the consultants and we went through all of the various options that are down there, it boiled down to, as the good representative to my left said, is some of the options were quite expensive when we modeled them both after the state of Washington. I think there was one in the Midwest that we looked at. We looked at having universities doing this. We looked about control functions. And by the time you put it on the oversight, we suddenly ran out of money to be able to do it. So what we came up with was the best plan we had at the moment. And we only took step one, as Senator Johnson pointed out, so that we'd be in a position to once again lock four people in the room and beat it out of each other.
Excellent. Thank you.
Excellent. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. First, I'd like to be associated with Senator Johnson's statements. They're pretty well aligned to what I had planned to say. I believe that I'm supportive of this bill, but I believe the Legislative Assembly should not be shy about hiring adequate staff to do the job right. There is no reason that I can comprehend why we should be starving ourselves for staff. We're doing the people's business. We need to have an adequate staff to do that. I think it's a good step in the right direction. It's a small step. I'd like to see a bigger step, but I support the bill.
Thank you. Representative Comp.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for 6 years of wonderful work, task force work and such. I really feel that I've missed the boat because this is something I've been very interested in, and the fact is that I have drafted bills and legislation that takes us to step two. And I'm looking at this group of members and the members that are sitting before me to think about step two. And that step is that we would have a bipartisan bicameral. It's House Bill 4051, if you want to look it up. And it would take the research that has been chosen and worked on and then say, well, what do we need to do? And I wasn't going to say this, but I'm going to. I'm really disappointed that my senator did not tell me about this work, and because I had shared with him repeatedly over the last 3 years about my interest, and I'm just thrilled that you guys stuck with it, and I hope you'll continue sticking with it.
Thank you. Any other questions? And colleagues, so many of you will remember that we dealt with this on the subcommittee, both in the 13-15 budget and in the 15-17 budget. So as our witnesses testified. Thank you both very much. Okay, Ms. McHugh, LFL recommendation.
The recommendation is to move to the full committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair.
With no amendments, right?
Correct.
All right, Madam Co-Chair, I move 1569A to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Move Senate Bill 1569A to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so Representative Nathanson, would you be kind enough to take this to full and
sure.
to the House floor?
Sure.
Thank you, and I'll have Senator Boquist take this in the Senate unless he objects. Thank you very much. All right, I am closing the work session on Senate Bill 1569. Colleagues, with respect to our esteemed co-chair of Ways and Means, we're going to do a slight order shift. We're going to switch. We're going to be opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1586 at this point. Do we have a list of witnesses? And Ms. Dannenhauer, can you get us up to date, please?
Sure. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1586 relating to voting directs public universities and community colleges to increase voter registration access and information. Provisions of the bill also direct Secretary of State to ensure that within 4 miles of public university and community college main campus, there is at least one location designated as an official ballot drop site. There was also provisions directing the secretary or that the statewide ballots be paid for with ballot provisions by mail. There is on OLIS recommended -A7, which the amendment removes provisions requiring the state to provide paid postage for each election held. And the amendment also clarifies the requirement that for official ballot drop sites within 4 miles of each school of higher education only applies to elections that are held within the electoral district in which the main campus of higher education is located.
Thank you. And before our esteemed co-chair goes, I'm going to say this. I really want to thank everybody who's come to testify. If all of you from Lane County want to testify, that's great, but I'm going to ask you to keep it really short. If you want to combine and have one person go longer, that's great too, but we've got a very, very full agenda, and I want to make sure that we keep moving. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Smith and members of the committee. I want to thank you for this opportunity to be here in favor of SB 1586A. I'm Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. This particular bill would reduce barriers to the ballot and maintain Oregon's place as a leader in voter access and participation. As a state, it is something to be proud of that we've been in the forefront of elections issues for many years with vote by mail, motor voter, and now hopefully SB 1586. SB 1586 is actually two bills within one, and I will explain here a little bit why you will only be voting on one of the bills that is actually within this bill. There were two bills originally in the bill. The first part would allow for paid postage on all ballots for all elections beginning after January 2017. This would be done through business reply envelopes, so only those ballots returned via mail would be charged to the state. After a great deal of examination of all the options that were available to actually have the ability to return ballots without putting postage on them, we determined that business reply envelopes would be a much cheaper option than actually putting postage on all ballots. So previous actual fiscals that you have seen in previous sessions, because this is not a new idea, nor will it be the last time you see the idea, because I'm sure that someone in the forthcoming session, if I am here in my current capacity, I will be introducing this in the next session. If I'm in a different capacity, I will be actually introducing this in the next session. But in this particular instance, we were able to get the fiscal down in this biennium to under $170,000, and in the next biennium to under $1.2 million. But actually, the dash sevens that you see will actually remove that portion of the bill. And so the bill is actually the second portion of the bill. This would provide more opportunities for nonpartisan voter registration efforts on higher education campuses and ensure that ballot boxes are located within a reasonable distance of the main campus. These particular sections have been negotiated over about the last 4 to 5 months. In OLIS, you will see a letter of support from all seven of our universities. So the community colleges have voiced no objections to the bill, and the universities are totally supportive. The language in here has been worked out with them and will give sort of a universal, in a sense, standards for voter registration activities on our campuses. I believe voting is a fundamental right, and the true purpose underlying this bill was simply to provide the greater potential of higher participation in our democracy, in our representative democracy. That's the underlying purpose of the bill. The bill that remains is still a good bill. It's not quite as good as the original bill would have been, but is very worthy of your support. The issues have been negotiated on what's remaining, both with the universities, community colleges, and the county clerks, and the counties, and everyone is on board on this. Also with the dash sevens, I will point out that with the dash sevens, we only anticipate a minimal fiscal, because under these standards, there will only be one or two additional boxes that will be required, drop-off boxes, in the entire state.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
A couple of questions, yeah. If the senator would respond. One of them is, in looking at the language of the bill, it goes out of its way to talk about nonpartisan. I'm curious how the enforcement of nonpartisan occurs. Specifically, you talk about places where nonpartisan voter registration can go on in designated public places. How do you assure that the Working Families Party is as prominent as the Democrats or as prominent as the R's? I'm just trying to figure out what's the standard to assure the nonpartisan nature of this bill?
First of all, I think it's spelled out within the bill that it is nonpartisan. Second, for those of us that have been involved, and I think many of you have been involved on both sides of the aisle in both chambers in voter registration efforts, when you're actually standing out in front of something trying to get people to register, you register whoever comes. I was just out doing that a month or so ago, so I think I had Democrats and I had Republicans registering, and you don't really differentiate. And I think it would be very difficult to do that, actually. It would be a very difficult process to do that. And obviously, on our campuses, there are both Democrats and Republicans, so I think
and green and communist and
every different party you can imagine. So it's been clear since the very beginning of our discussions with the university. It's been clear with our discussions with the Oregon Student Association that these are clearly, and they're spelled out as nonpartisan registration efforts. Yes.
Thank you. I know that that's the word that's in here. And what I'm trying to do is to assure equity on the ground, particularly when in one of the sections it talks about getting the names and professional addresses of professors so as to facilitate, I presume, additional conversation. How do you guarantee that the bias is removed from this, and what is the process for registering violations or discontent if a professor has their thumb on the scale one way or another?
My understanding of this, and it might be better to question one of the other parties, actually the normal process has been to request these lists of faculty members. To be honest, in many universities, these lists are actually online and already available. In this, it spells out that this responding either to the official student government or its equivalent in doing this. It's not so much an issue that the professor is actually presenting this, because most would not. It's an issue of whether they get a few minutes access to the classroom. And those that are familiar with academia know that actually that professors treat their classrooms as their territory. And actually at the university level, it's very much their territory and recognized by the university administration. So basically students have to ask if they can come in and do nonpartisan. And usually they probably just get a few minutes.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Whitson.
Thank you. First, you know, I believe that informed voting is a fundamental responsibility.
Yeah.
But several questions. One, on the ballot boxes, who pays for those?
We will under this circumstance.
Okay. We will, the state?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And secondly, on lines 11 through 15, we talk about upon the request of the school's official student government or its equivalent, give the student government or its equivalent an opportunity to provide nonpartisan voter registration services. Why do we need a law for that? I mean, every university I've gone to has that ability already.
I think actually the reason is just to make it uniform. It will simply make it easier when the student government requests it. We've had a lot of discussions with all of the university representatives on this, the discussion was basically that to put this in the statute just provides a lot of comfort in terms of sort of a universal standard.
And one final question. On page 2, line 10, well, if the school owns and operates any student housing at least 3 months prior to each primary or general election, they must obtain from the local county elections office what address information students are going to use on campus. What is the law on residency for a student? Are they a resident of campus, or are they a resident in their district? And if they're receiving a ballot on campus, do they receive a ballot regarding the elections in that district, or do they receive a ballot that is the district of their residence, their domicile?
Okay. I will speak here as a member of the Senate. I can probably bring the Secretary of State in to give that presentation, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt. But the reality is that students can select whatever they choose to do. They can select to be a resident where their campus is located, if they live on the campus. If they live somewhere else in the state, they can maintain their residency there if they do actually have a residence there. So, for instance, if they still have family in the state, like a parent, they can still utilize that residence to actually be their voting residence. If they live outside of the state, most states will allow them to be an absentee, as a student, so that they can actually register in their home state. Some students will choose to actually register where they're going to school. Others will choose to register in to keep their existing registration. And obviously some students are not intending to stay in Oregon and may remain registered in their own state.
That's an interesting discussion that we should have offline.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for Senator Devlin? Senator, thank you for bringing this bill in front of us. We appreciate it very much.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity. And I'm here also in support of the Dash 7s, although I'm disappointed that we're only doing the Dash 7s.
One step at a time, Senator. Thank you very much. Okay, I'd like Nikki Fisher and Wood Lane County folks decide, one or all of you? Did you figure that out? All of you? Great.
Yeah.
We're going to start with Nikki Fisher, Christian Mello, and Candolin Johnson then. Thank you. Ms. Fisher, go ahead.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Smith, and members of the committee, my name is Nikki Fisher, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Bus Project. We're an organization focused on engaging young people in the democratic process by making it fun and accessible. The bus drives votes, it drives leaders, and it drives change. The Bus Project knows that our democracy is at its healthiest and most robust when citizens can participate with ease and voice their opinions and views through voting. We support SB 1586. We understand that the postage portion of this bill will likely be amended out with the Dash 7s. We're disappointed because we believe this is a critical, but we absolutely support the other two factors of this bill moving forward. We support adding additional drop-box locations to college campuses. Right now, many college students have limited access to cars and often walk and use public transit. We need citizens to be able to turn in their ballots in an easy as possible way. Opponents of this bill have stated that it's easy to drop off your ballot, but we know that for many people, it's not that easy. The closest drop box location at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg is 7.7 miles from campus. We believe with SB 1586, Oregon can take an important step forward and remove additional barriers to participating in democracy by adding Dropbox locations and ensuring students are able to register their peers to vote. There are some inaccuracies floating around about the second piece of this, vote by mail with business reply postage that we want to clear up. First, in this bill is business reply, not prepaid postage like some media outlets reported. So the charges only if the mail is returned, not paid postage on all ballots. We believe that ensuring a stamp to mail your ballot is a true barrier, and we worry having a stamp dissuades voters from participating in elections. A stamp costs 49 cents today, but it does not cost just 49 cents. It costs the additional time it takes to find that stamp as well. Can you make it to the post office between 9 to 5 while you're working? Do you have time to stop at the grocery store before picking your kids up to get a stamp? If you go to the grocery store currently and buy a book of stamps, it's $9.80. This isn't about lazy kids, but rather about a changing world. The right to vote is a fundamental principle of democracy. To vote, each individual must take time to consider each candidate and each issue, whether sitting down to caucus in Nevada or to stand in line at a polling station in South Carolina. Here in Oregon, you can vote in the privacy of your home, and it takes time. It takes time to consider your voices and your choices. It's an act of voting that is a responsibility and a privilege, not the act of finding a stamp. The last thing that I'll say is that a Pew Charitable Trust article recently said that 56% of Oregonians drop off their ballot by Dropbox location. The first reason they gave was convenience. The second most popular reason was because Oregonians had a desire to save the cost of postage. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm going to hear from the rest of the panel, and then we can ask questions. Thank you. Go ahead. Please introduce yourself.
Oh, is this working? Cool.
Yep. Don't have to be too close. They're pretty sensitive.
For sure. Co-chairs Steiner Hayward and Smith, members of the committee. My name is Christian Mello, and I'm a junior at Oregon State University and a member of its student government. And I'm here with the Oregon Student Association to urge your support of Senate Bill 1586. This bill has a major impact on students' ability to participate in the democratic process in the state of Oregon. It directs public universities and community colleges to work with student governments to increase voter registration access on their campuses. You all know this bit, so I can safely skip over it.
Yes.
During the last election cycle, I did voter registration and education while I was still a student at Lane Community College. During this campaign, most of our time was spent telling folks where, when, and how they could vote. The biggest problem was that there was not, and still is not, an official ballot box at LCC, which created a significant barrier to students casting their ballots. This put an unfair burden on students, both in the student government and outside of it, as students had to take time out of their schedule to transport ballots to an election office, and others had to worry about non-official ballot boxes not getting their ballots in on time. A community college is a place where people come to receive an affordable education, and it's also a place where non-traditional students come to start new lives. This population has little time to worry about the specifics of voting when they're often balancing jobs, families, and classwork. Taking time out of a very complicated schedule to get to the post office to buy a book of stamps is something that many non-traditional students may have difficulties doing. This bill would ensure that one of the last barriers that people in Oregon have to voting disappears and would modernize our voting system. I would still support this bill if the stamp part were not included, as mentioned earlier, but it would be really excellent if it was included. I've since transferred to Oregon State University, and I serve in government relations in their student government. Our school has been very helpful in letting us register students to vote, and our registrar has done great work in giving us class lists. But having that be institutionalized, having that support be institutionalized, would make the biggest difference for our work. But yeah, this is why I support Senate Bill 1586 and encourage this committee to pass it. And just remember my story when voting on this bill. And thank you for letting me speak with you.
Thank you so much. Please.
Hello, my name is Candelin. Oh, okay. Sorry. It's all good. Thank you, co-chairs.
Can you give us your last name, please?
Johnson.
Well. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
Thank you, co-chairs Steiner, Hayward, and Smith, and members of the committee. I'm a third-year student at Lynn Benton Community College and Oregon State University. I'm dual enrolled. And I'm going to put this kind of over here. And I am here with the Oregon Students Association to urge you to support Senate Bill 1586. This bill is really important to increase civic engagement for youth. We all know that youth are increasing their numbers every year of participation in Oregon for voting. And a lot of that is due to the nonpartisan voter registration work that has been going on campuses. And so I think that it's really important to recognize that this bill would increase those numbers of youth participating in the democratic process that we have here in Oregon. I also think that currently some colleges have restrictions on the access that student leaders can have at certain events, and this bill would make it so that student leaders would have access to orientations for new students and other dorm activities in order to register students to vote. It also ensures that ballot drop-off locations are more readily available for students, because at present, almost all campuses don't really have one anywhere near. I know at LBCC, we don't have anyone within a good distance. It's pretty far. I'm actually the student body president at Lippman Community College, and I was a part of the nonpartisan voter registration campaign in 2014, where we had an unofficial drop-off box. But because a lot of students actually ride the bus to campus, they don't really have transportation to be able to get to the ballot drop-off boxes, and so a lot of times we would miss the deadlines to be able to turn our ballots in on time for students. It also was the lack of resources, because we had our other duties of like actually having someone who had time and had a car to go to an official drop-off box to turn in all of those ballots for students. Was actually a really big strain on our resources during the campaign. And so that's one of the reasons why I really support official drop-off boxes being more readily accessible for students on all campuses. And the last thing I was going to mention was about the stamp. I just know that it would, that many resort to buying stamps at like local supermarkets because the inaccessibility of hours at the post office. I know that I tried to go to the post office the other day, and it took me like 3 weeks to be able to get there because it was 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., which is prime time for classes. And so I actually had to skip one of my classes to be able to go to the post office, which is not something that I usually condone as a student leader for students to do. Buying stamps at a local supermarket, you can't just buy one. You have to buy the whole book, and that's like $10 out of your pocket, which you wouldn't think is a lot of money, but for students, every penny counts sometimes. I mean, I run a food drive on campus, and I understand that students, every penny counts. And so I understand that this is probably going to be dropped from the bill, but I would still support it, and I know the Oregon Students Association still supports it. And I just wanted it on the record that I support having that on there, if so.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
That's great. I apologize if I'm cutting you off a little bit, but I want to make sure other people get a chance to testify, and we've got a packed agenda. Yep. Questions for this panel? Senator Johnson.
Is it or is it not possible to print a stamp off on a computer?
Possible, but I don't know about legal.
Well,
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee. It is possible to print a stamp off of the computer, but that means that you have to have access to a credit card in order to print the stamp. So many individuals who have financial situations oftentimes don't have a credit card or debit card to purchase that. We do think it's an additional barrier to go. It assumes that you have internet access, and it assumes that you have a credit card to purchase that stamp.
Senator Whitson.
Behave.
I didn't say anything.
You mentioned an unofficial drop-off box.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Who maintains the ballot security, and how is that security maintained in an unofficial ballot box? I never heard of an unofficial ballot box drop-off.
Well, for our voter registrations, we have only one on campus, and that, and the entire administration and our advisor knows about it, and it's in the public eye. So there's not, like, it's not in a secret room where one person could do something with them. It's in a place that's very visible, and it's in our student government office. And so and we usually have the ballot drop. The students will come in and put their ballots in there. And then at the end of the day, we'll just take the box and bring it to the elections office.
Senator.
Is someone from security on campus?
They're also aware that the box is there.
Are they? They have that box in their view at all times?
No. I'm sorry, they have what?
Somebody from security on your campus, somebody is responsible for having that ballot box in their view at all times?
In the view? I would have to check on that. I mean, I wasn't in charge of the ballot box. That wasn't really something that I was in charge of. And so I can't give you the specifics as to whether a security officer was looking over it. Okay. But I do understand why.
I think you've answered the question, and I will follow up on it with the Secretary of State.
Okay.
Thank you.
But if I may, just to clarify, maybe Ms. Fisher, you know the answer to this question. If not, again, maybe we can get the answer from the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. It is legal in this state for people to collect sealed ballots from others to deliver them to drop boxes. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
So as long as those ballots are sealed and signed on the outside in the way that we all have to do, that's having that unofficial drop box. I appreciate Senator Whitson your point, but I just want to clarify that what you're doing is no different than sending anything around. Got it. Senator Devlin just kindly brought me something. RS 260.695 says, Oregon law allows anyone to collect ballots. However, the law requires that anyone collecting ballots must clearly state unofficial on the collection box. Oregon law requires the lettering on the unofficial drop box be at least 50-point bold font size and in all caps. The following is in the official text and a sample of the minimum size using 50-point bold Arial font, not an official drop box ballot drop site. For those of you watching from home, that's what it looks like. So I appreciate your concern, Senator, but it sounds like what they're doing is legal. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Okay, we got to keep rocking and rolling, folks. I have Devin Backstrom, Tasha Briquet, I hope I pronounced your name correctly, and Amber Potratz. And I'm going to ask you guys to really limit it to less than 2 minutes apiece. And if somebody's already said what you're going to say, I would encourage you to just say, I'd like to echo what others have said about these points and keep moving, because I want to make sure we can get to other things on our agenda. Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Devin Backstrom, and good afternoon, co-chairs, Steiner, Hayward, and Smith. I'm a biology major. I'm also the academic affairs director at ASPSU. I've done voter registration for approximately 12 terms now, so I can tell you quite a bit about how we do voter registration at PSU. I was motivated to write this testimony after hearing the claim that students who do not vote are lazy because they're not willing to buy a stamp and turn in their ballots. I started off by trying to list the dozens of things I do daily. I intended to start off with my 5 a.m. wake-up call, walk you through my daily schedule until midnight each day. I intended to guide you through the 15 credit hours I'm taking in my classes on neurophysiology, endocrinology, human genetics. I wanted to guide you through my day without food, my inability to afford parking, and even my struggle to afford the public transit. I wanted to show you the exhilaration of going to college for your dream, to become a doctor, and the gauntlet that I run to make that dream real. I wanted to prove to you the hundreds of different things that are required of me each day and explain the hours lost each night worrying about what else I might have forgotten. In the end, I really wanted to show I really wanted to share a lot with you, but I don't have nearly enough time to fit a 19-hour day into a 2-minute testimony. Students aren't having a hard time voting because they don't care. I struggle because I have a life with a routine that's precariously balanced on my ability to manage hundreds of different deadlines and expectations that I have on a daily basis. Sometimes when I've filled out my ballot, driving down to the post office or the ballot office is not something I have the time or the money to do. Sometimes when I'm at the grocery store, my priority is buying foods rather than buying a book of stamps. And a book of stamps costs a lot more than 49 cents. The average age of PSU students is 28. And like myself, we all have busy lives filled with these tough decisions of budgeting our time and expenses and having to make strategic cuts. I'm a full-time student, and the fact is the status quo, as it currently stands, easily disenfranchises people like me who don't have the luxury of a stable home address, unscheduled free time, or a free spending budget. Voting is not right. Voting is a right, not a luxury, and we should be doing everything in our power as a state to make voting easy and accessible for all. I look forward to all supporting the civic engagement bill and furthering our democracy.
Thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate it. Please.
Hi, co-chairs Smith and Steiner here. My name is Tasha Burkay, and I'm a student with the Associated Students of Lane Community College and a member of the Oregon Student Association. And I'm here today to speak specifically on voting accessibility and urge you to support Senate Bill 1586. As a student leader and an Oregon citizen, I care very deeply about my duty to vote, but it's just not accessible to me. I'm a student with disabilities. I have seizures and I can't drive. I go to a school whose campus is in the hills on the outskirts of both cities it services. And taking a bus for an hour and a half just to drop off a ballot isn't very feasible for me or for plenty of others in the state in my position. It's not for lack of caring about my constitutional rights and obligations, trust me. For some additional context, my regular day starts off when I leave my home at 7:30 in the morning, only to continue after I return home 13 hours later with homework to start. My day is filled with a 15-credit course load, my work as a senator, my work study in the food pantry, the collaborations I do with our disability services, and my duties as the treasurer of the Gender and Sexuality Alliance, one of our identity unions on campus. And with all that, my time rapidly disappears. My days are long and arduous, and it leaves very little time to go across town to drop off a ballot or secure a stamp. We as a state have an opportunity to make a significant impact on voting accessibility to non-traditional students like myself, especially at community colleges and regional universities. Please pass Senate Bill 1586. Even without the stamp part, I'm fine with that, so students like myself can have more opportunity to vote.
Thank you so much. Please.
Hello, hello, co-chair Smith and Steiner Hayward and members of the committee. My name is Amber Potras, and I'm a student at the University of Oregon, along with being the State Affairs Coordinator for the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. I'm here today to talk to you about how SB 1586 would make nonpartisan student-run, student-led voter registration campaigns more accessible, like the one I'm currently organizing to be kicking off this spring term. One of the huge ways it would make it allow us to register a lot more voters is it would give us access to new student orientations, which are mandatory on the University of Oregon campus, along with access to dorm move-ins and dorm hall meetings. Last year, the University of Oregon's entering class, including freshmen and transfers, was 5,367. If we had access to these new student orientation programs and dorm move-in and dorm hall meetings, we could have registered all these new students who have just recently moved to Eugene to attend the University of Oregon. The bill would also make the voting process a lot more accessible, which you've already heard from Tasha. Another huge thing is I go to the University of Oregon where we have a ballot drop box on campus. This has made my life a lot more accessible and has made it so I've never actually missed an election, and I will be voting in current elections. Having a ballot drop box on campus and near campus has made voting a lot more accessible for students.
Thank you so much. Question, Senator Johnson.
How would you guarantee that in these dorm orientations that the presentations are nonpartisan?
The way it'd be nonpartisan is we are registering students with we are not backing any candidates or mentioning candidates. We are just registering students.
That wasn't my question. My question was, how do you make sure they're nonpartisan? You're going to have Democrats, Republicans, Working Family, Green, Independent Party of Oregon. I'm directing my question to her. Thank you.
Actually, my pronouns are they, them, theirs. I'm trans, so. My colleague, Devin, who is also a student, would be able to answer
the,
this.
The very simple answer here is that you don't go into anything partisan in the first place. You don't talk about ballot measures. You don't talk about politics or anything like that. You talk about voter registration. You keep it talking about voter registration. As soon as you start talking about anything else, you're already off the deep end, and you can already be challenged for a lot of different things that you're doing wrong. So we just avoid the whole situation in the first place, which is exactly what the Republican and Democratic parties do when they go out and do voter registration themselves.
Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you so much for participating down here. And if I come across as cranky, please don't take it that way. And Senator, I'm good with the bill. Two thoughts. One, do we need a bill to put drop boxes on university campuses? Can't we just talk to the Secretary of State and say, hey, could you help us with this and get them on the campus? Two, and I mean this with all due respect, and I want to give you a little background very quickly. I've got a son who's graduating from BYU heading to law school. I've got a kid at Oregon State in the mechanical engineering program, in the master's program. I got a kid at Utah Valley doing whatever he does. I'm not sure. But I get the bill.
We won't go there.
I've got another kid. I got another kid that just got accepted to Washington State, is heading there in the fall or after his mission. And so I say this with all due respect. You mean to tell me a postage stamp, and I know it's amended out, would keep you from voting?
I can speak on that. I make actually just under what my rent is.
No, I get all that. Trust me. I know. We've all been there. I couldn't afford Taco Bell when I was in the MBA program at Portland State. You mean to tell me a postage stamp would keep you from voting?
So I can't acquire it.
All right. I'll let it go. I'm crazy. So, I just had to get that off my chest, and I'll probably get removed this chair.
I'd love to address that particular part. In my particular case, a postage stamp is not going to keep me from voting. No. A postage stamp is adding another 15-minute trip or another hour-long trip. And when you're doing things at the last minute, already having these precariously balanced schedules on your back, trying to get that in the last minute is exactly why we see so many young people and people that don't have stable addresses kind of go towards that.
So if I hear you correctly, it's not going to keep you from voting, but it is a barrier to voting.
Correct.
All right. I can live with that.
And it's the difference between me making it to my class or not, which I already have a hard enough time in attendance, missing them from seizures.
And I'm sorry, I'm cranky. It's 4 o'clock. I'm tired.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt.
Just an observation question. Is it not possible to buy a postage stamp at your student union? And if not, why not?
That's a very good question. Honestly, I have no idea.
You have no idea whether you can buy a postage stamp at your student union?
When I buy postage stamps, because I don't live on campus, I buy them at the grocery store, and I buy them in a booklet.
You go to college on campus, though?
So. Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much. Are there any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 1586.
Okay. We have before you the A7 amendment, which has a minimal fiscal impact, as discussed by Senator Devlin. And it's ready to go.
Thank you.
So, Madam Co-Chair, I'd move the dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 1586.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith moves the dash A7 amendment to Senate Bill 1586. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition?
I do have a question, a procedural question. Do we have a fiscal on these amendments?
Ms. Dauenhauer said that there was a minimal fiscal.
It is also, if you go on to OLIS, you'll have to scroll down into the meeting materials, and it'll be SB 1586-A7, and it's abbreviated FIS. It doesn't say fiscal.
There's been a lot of materials added at the last minute. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? If not, motion passes.
So, Madam Co-Chair, I move Senate Bill 1586 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith moves Senate Bill 1586 as amended to the full committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there opposition to the motion? Discussion or opposition?
On the bill. Discussion on the bill.
Yes, Representative.
So just quickly, and some may see my point, some may not. I plan on voting for the bill. frankly, it was an easier yes for me before some of the testimony. As somebody who's had several family members in active combat to fight for our freedoms and rights, it is so discouraging and disappointing to hear people say that they can't make a two-hour walk if necessary to go make the Dropbox drop-off for the right to vote. I mean, I know the stamps aren't part of it, but just the priorities. The excuses that somehow they don't have the time is difficult for me to deal with, and I'm not sorry for making that point.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Your opposition to the motion. Senator Smith Whitsitt. Whew.
It's getting long.
Okay. Otherwise, motion passes. Thank you. Senator Devlin, I assume you'll want to take this to full.
The chair.
And then I'm assuming Representative Hoyle is going to want to take this in the House. Okay? I see heads nodding. Good. I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 1586. We will now resume our regularly scheduled programming. And we're going to move into we're going to open a work session on the individual account program. Okay, the Public Employee Retirement System Individual Account Program, Mr. Borden.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. Before you is the Public Employees Retirement System with an additional ask for their individual account program. The individual account program project is a project to move in-house the third-party administration of part of this program.
Mr. Rodman, welcome back. Long time no see.
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Hayward and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Rodman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System. In light of the late hour and the crankiness of the other co-chair, I quite rapidly, and also many of the committee members have already seen this in the IT committee. Basically, I want to take just a few minutes to tell you a story, and the story is about the technology strategy that we're pursuing in administering the retirement system that we do. So this slide is hopefully not new to those of you who have been paying attention to PERS over the years. This is the slide we used to introduce our concept when we came to you for the RIMS Conversion Project, or RCP. One of those little known but successful state-sponsored IT projects where we spent $35 million to build a new system, came in on time and on budget. But as always, the concept for this IT system was a component, and components that can be swapped in and swapped out, added and changed as we went over time. So the puzzle piece metaphor has moved on in how we present this, but basically we started with the puzzle piece, and the IEP project is another piece of the puzzle that we're looking to address. So what also has evolved over time, of course, is the capabilities of the system that we use. This is a slide from our system provider, Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, which just shows the evolution of the business tool that we use, which is called jClarity. And only to note that, of course, we bought this back in 2004, and things have happened over the last 12 years that have changed the dynamics and ability of computer systems to provide services that we use. So that work and evolution has continued, and what we're seeking is a supplement to our IAP, as well as a discussion later about our technology platform, jClarity, that this is built on. So that evolution has come to a demonstration more like this component piece rather than the puzzle pieces. We're looking at the different kinds of things an administration system needs to do. In support of members, employers, and PERS staff, we need things like a web and mobile enabled portals, what's called an enterprise service bus that lets all these things talk to each other, a member database, which also has all of our data and information about our members, and then functionality behind it, contact management, enterprise content management, imaging rules, OPSERP functionality with the new system that came in, benefit estimates and calculations. The point of this slide is to use color to illustrate that some of these things are things we already have. Those are the gray boxes. Some of these are things that could be dramatically improved by plugging a different component in, like the burgundy boxes. And some are in the midst of transition, which is the shading like the web and mobile portals. So the point is the technology requests that we're making related to IEP and others are going to be, in the future, plugging in different pieces of these components as we move forward. So moving ahead quickly, if I can get this to cooperate. Getting to IEP in particular, as LFO introduced, we have come to back to you with some supplemental requests for funding because the scope of this project has changed. The methodology that we're following has been adopted to follow LFO's recommendation from 2015 relating to following the stage gate process. Increases in scope, increases in schedule mean an increase in the time for delivery and an increase in the budget. So we're asking for an additional allocation in this biennium to support that level of work. And then we'll be coming back to you in 17-19 for additional budget dollars to close out the project by delivery date of January 1, 2019. So as to this item, that's the information I wanted to present.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
If I understand you correctly, you have said that the increased rigor of the review of your case statement is driving the increase in costs. Is that correct?
That's a component of the increase in cost, Co-Chair Stanley Hayward, Senator Johnson. We had a different approach to this project prior to LFO's direction and the direction of OSCIO in 2015. They want us to follow the stage gate process. This project started before stage gate even existed. By following stage gate, you do a couple of things, one of which is you define all of the work you're going to do, and we had not done all of that. We just figured, what is it going to take to get us to this point where we could cut over? There are many dynamics. That's probably the main drivers. We're going to do more work under this project than we were
before. Good, because it begs the other question that had you not figured out a coherent, rational business case, the potential for failure seemed pretty high. We've sat in this very room and listened to project after project that didn't go through the front-end rigor, and we have paid the price, including $6 million in legal bills. And so ordinarily, I'd be pretty cranky about a cost estimate that is $4 million out of, well, that's not fair, 3.1 out of whack. But if it now means a greater degree of front-end rigor that will prevent the screw-ups that have been the hallmark of the past, I get a lot more comfortable. And I guess I would turn to Mr. Cummings and ask about what are the fail-safes that you see at this point, particularly if we allow additional funding in this, to keep us from having yet another giant computer screw-up.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Cummings. I would say that in 2015, when PERS came in, they were at basically between stage gate 2 and 3. And their estimates at stage gate 2 is minus or plus 25%. At stage gate 3, it's minus or plus 10%. They did not have the artifacts in place for a stage gate 3 funding recommendation from LFO or the state OSCIO.
And can we dial down the acronyms, yeah. Those of us that don't speak
Sorry.
Fluent acronym?
Well, for the State Office of Chief Information Officer
Thank
and
you.
The LFO, we do reviews at Stage Gate 3, and they didn't have all that work done. So we recommended that they go back and get that work done. They have done, Jeff Moss of PERS has done an outstanding job of getting that foundational work done. We do expect, in all fairness to the agency, we do expect that between stage gate 2 and 3 that you will have some changes in the size of the estimates going from minus plus 25% to minus plus 10%. And at this particular point, the PERS has their QA on board. They are working closely with the Office of the State Chief Information Officer. They have full ongoing costs identified for the project. And while there certainly is never a guarantee This is highly likely that on January of 2018 that the cut over will be successful for this particular project. Your LFO feels cautiously optimistic that this project is now in good shape to go forward, and we've recommended to the JLCIMT that they add the additional funding and let it go forward. If for no other reason, this project will save a couple of $1 million a year, I believe, in cost to PERS.
Thank you. Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Has a quality assurance company that is on board on this project been associated with any of the failed computer implementations?
Co-Chair, Senator Johnson's member of the committee. I believe that the vendor is Maximus, and of course Maximus was the QA for Cover Oregon.
Great. That's a comfort. Thank you.
Mr. Cummings, just to clarify, are they also the QA for other projects that are ongoing and are going well?
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, Maximus overall has done an excellent job of QA oversight on a number of projects that are nationally known. And they, in all fairness to them, on Cover Oregon, they reported regularly of the problems that that project had. This is a much smaller project. They have a very senior oversight analyst on it, and I'm pretty comfortable that this project will go well, particularly because your LFO and the Office of State CIO is going to be all over it.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Mr. Warden.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I think it's good to wrap up this by saying that this project is a poster child for validation of the stage gate review process, that these costs are not all attributable to the oversight. There's just a thoroughness that now has been conducted with the project, and the costs are a lot, and the cost scope and schedule are now far better defined. I would note for the record that the agency is planning to come back to the next legislative session with an additional ask to close out this project. So at this point, LFO recommends that the $1,255,601 increase to PERS other funds expenditure limitation, and that the limitation be added into the budget reconciliation bill, and additionally that all previously unscheduled funding other funds limitation for the project be scheduled.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I know that we have, or at least I believe that we have you as chair of this committee and also a liaison to the information technology.
Yeah, and Representative Nathanson is the House co-chair of that one.
Okay. Because we do these conversations in the segmented way that we do them, we're not all of us hear all the information at the same time. Was anything surfaced in the other committee that gave rise to concern about anything we're hearing here today, many of us for the first time and not in depth?
Not that I recall. I would ask LFO staff if there's something I'm forgetting.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, I'm not aware of anything additional. Okay. Perhaps Mr. Borden is, but I'm not.
Thank you. Anything else?
So, Madam Co-Chair, I move we accept LFO's recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith moves that we accept LFO's recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved. And we don't need to do anything else, right, Mr. Borden? Cool. I'm closing the work session on the Public Employee Retirement System Individual Account Program and opening a work session on the Public Employee Retirement System Information Technology Technical Debt. Mr. Borden.
Madam Co-Chair, again, PERS is here with another information technology request for $1.7 million for updates to the J-Clarity retirement system.
Mr. Rodman.
Thank you. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, again, Steve Rodman, Director of the Public Employee Retirement System. This request is a carryover from our 2015 budget request in this sense. We came to you with a policy package in that budget cycle to ask for two components, one of which was updating functionality for the J-Clarity system. The other is to address what is called technical debt. Technical debt arises when you have any system that you are living with for a long period of time, as we are with Clarity. And it is akin, there are many metaphors that have been tried, it's akin to trying to keep an airplane flying while you're trying to do maintenance on it. At some point, you have to land the airplane, swap out some components, and actually firm up what its capabilities are before you take off in the airplane again. So what we would like to do is land the plane, that is JClarity, and update this functionality in a number of areas that are listed in the request. And in the interest of time, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I could go through some of those in some detail, or they are in greater detail in the information we provided to the IT committee. It's up to you.
I would defer to my subcommittee's members. We do still have several items on the agenda. That being said, I don't want anybody to feel that they aren't getting adequate information to address this request properly. Senator Johnson.
The presentation just begs this question. Batch job failures and improve error handling. Those are not words that instill a high degree of comfort for some of us.
Perhaps I'll address that one then, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Johnson.
Go for it.
So our system operates on a daily cycle, and we close our system down at the end of the day and run a batch job that then incorporates all of the changes that we've made into our record keeping. There are times when one or some of those elements fail, and that failure needs to come to someone's attention, needs to be correctly diagnosed, and then either immediately or the next day, that failure has to be remedied. So, for example, in the batch job, we may have loaded a number of withdrawal payments to go out in that day. And for some reason, that element or that job may fail. We need to know that that didn't happen so that the money didn't go out the door that we expected. And then the next day, either remedy that in any number of ways. Run the batch job again, or set it up to run another night, the next night. What this package lets us do is improve the handling of those errors so that we better understand the diagnostics behind those failures, and so that we can have a better notification structure to the batch job, so maybe they aren't as dependent on each other. So it's improving the way in which we handle such failures and errors.
To the tune of $425,000,
$430,000. If you're adding those numbers correctly, I'm relying on your putting those together.
Good enough for government work.
Well, the batch job failure, the improved error handling, the last item is part of that as well. Yes, part of that tracing of the error to understand what part of the system actually generated the problem we're having.
Other specific questions for Mr. Rodman about this? Okay, then I'm going to let you off the hook unless, Mr. Cummings, you want to add anything at this point.
Co-chairs, Senator Snyder Hayward, just briefly, one of the concerns that the LFO has in all agencies is that we have major investments. JClarity is $35 million. When we come in for enhancements, we like to think that there's a plan in place that describes how we're going to maintain it, utilize it, and keep it alive for an extended period of time. And your LFO recommendation is to approve the funding, but to unschedule it and have PERS come back with a plan for not only JClarity, but for Orion, which could be up to hundreds of millions of dollars of investment. We just want to see what the overall modernization plan is and how this fits into it, and what's likely to happen downstream, for example, when JClarity is enhanced with the new HP stuff. So that's why we've recommended that the funding be approved, because this is a $35 million investment. 1.6 is not a major amount of money for a system that big. But we don't know the full picture, the big picture, and that's why we're asking the agency to come back, work with the LFO and with the Office of State CIO, and come back with the full picture, such that we can recommend unscheduling and let them move forward with their enhancements.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Ford.
LFO recommends the $1,659,976 increase to PERS other funds expenditure limitation be included in the budget reconciliation bill, and that the Department of Administrative Services unschedules the entire amount.
So, Madam Co-Chair, I would move we concur with LFO's recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith moves that we concur with LFO's recommendation. Is there discussion of the motion? Is there objection to the motion? If not, so moved. Thank you.
Can I just say something briefly?
Yes,
you
please.
Asked previously that we give a preview of some discussions we're having on IAP investments. Those slides are in the presentation. I don't want to go through them as you have not time for that, but I just wanted to note they're in there so people like to review
Thank
them
you.
And have questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Okay, I'm closing the work session on the Public Employee Retirement System Individual Account Program. I'm opening a work session on I'm opening a public hearing. Sorry, excuse me. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 4012 relating to water.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 4012A is a bill authorizes issuance of lottery bonds to be deposited in Water Quality Monitoring Fund to conduct, fund, or reimburse local governments for water quality monitoring and analysis related to dam removal. Establishes the Water Quality Monitoring Fund and the amount to be deposited for the from the proceeds of the lottery bonds has not been specified at this time.
Thank you very much. Senator Whitson, delightful to have you sitting over there. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I would note that after waiting patiently for an hour and 45 minutes, Representative Whitson was not able to remain to present this bill. So this is an amendment, the Dash 3 amendment to the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the Oregon groundwater law is complex, and sometimes, for the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitson. I represent Senate District 28.
Yeah, Greg.
The Oregon groundwater law is complex and sometimes difficult to understand. So, in broad strokes, irrigation wells that are located within a mile of a surface water source are assumed to have the potential to interfere, that is, to draw water from the surface water source. In the event that the well interference actually occurs and causes measurable reduction in the water available for surface water right, the Water Resources Department then must regulate the irrigation well to prevent that interference. When a well is located within a quarter of a mile of the surface water, the burden of proof is on the well owner to show by a preponderance of evidence that their well does not interfere. If a well is located between a quarter of a mile and a mile from the surface water source, the burden of proof is on the Water Resources Department to show by a preponderance of evidence that the well does interfere. If it's beyond a mile, it requires a critical groundwater analysis. So the problem that this Dash 3 amendment is attempting to address is how the proof of interference is to be established. The Water Resources Department has created computerized regional and local groundwater models for the Klamath River Basin, and the department claims that the models established by the models actually established the preponderance of evidence needed to prove that the wells do interfere. And the department is now asserting that the well owner must prove that the wells do not interfere. So what the department has accomplished is, by employing computer modeling, they have shifted the burden of proof from the well owner, from the department to the well owner. Under this scenario, the well owner is required to bear the cost of a steady state pump test and other aquifer analysis to prove that his well does not cause interference. And this can be difficult because the department has testified repeatedly that in many cases, it cannot measure the interference allegedly caused by a single well. So you're trying to prove a negative without being able to measure it. Further, the department is already required to establish that a well is not likely to interfere with a surface water source before issuing a permit or certificate to use the groundwater. So the availability of the water and the likelihood that the interference will not occur is already established when they provide the permit or their certificate. Moreover, the owner of the wells that are currently being regulated in Upper Klamath Basin by the department were prohibited from making a water right claim in the adjudication, the surface water adjudication, under which their wells are now being regulated. So, the amendment before you would clarify existing law to spell out what the department must do before it can shut down an irrigation well for interference and thereby take the private property irrigation rights of the well owner by an administrative process. Section by section, Section 2 establishes how the distance between the well and the water, the surface water will be measured. Section 3 defines, in sub 1, defines the terms and establishes the qualifications for a hydrogeologist who might be employed to analyze that potential well interference. Sub 2 requires the department to disclose the evidence upon which it proposes to regulate a well. It establishes the minimum information that a hydrogeologist must obtain in making an interference analysis. And it establishes how the evidence must show regulation of the well will substantially improve surface water availability for a surface water user with a higher water right, higher priority water right, meaning if by regulating the well, there will be a sufficient response in the surface water source that is measurable and quantifiable, and it can actually show an improvement in the ability of the senior water right holder to use their water. Sub 5 establishes an aquifer analysis on a well need not be repeated each time the department tries to regulate the well. So, I mean, if you have established once that it does interfere, the next year most likely it's going to interfere again unless the well has been deepened or that it's been some major change has been made. And sub 6 confirms that the department is responsible for the cost incurred in the analysis and that the analysis is made available to the well owner at no cost. We originally, prior to the groundwater modeling, the department was responsible for the cost of proving that the well was not interfering or was interfering. Now, we're saying that the department is suggesting that there's a major fiscal for them to pay for the analysis, which they have now shifted to the cost of the well owner. So when we come to talking about fiscals on a bill like this, you need to keep in mind that only by virtue of the groundwater modeling reaching the preponderance of evidence are they able to require the well owner to do this. And finally, a little history on the conflict that created the need for this legislation. Klamath River adjudication has been in the progress for 30 years. One of the very first hurdles was a tribal claim for water rights retained when the tribe sold the reservation to the United States government. The sale, repeatedly solicited by the tribes, allowed for retention of the water rights to hunt, fish, and gather on historic reservation lands, basically the in-stream water right. The Ninth Circuit Court in Adair decisions decided and established that the tribes did retain a water right for in-stream use, and that its priority date should be time immemorial. It's untrumpable. You shouldn't use that term anymore, should you?
No.
However, the court stated the amount of water should be no more than the tribes were using to maintain a moderate standard of living at the time the court ruling was made. Inexplicably, the Water Resources Department gave the tribes virtually all of the water tributary to Upper Klamath Lake as a in-stream water right callable on the people who own their water rights. So it also ruled that the levels in Upper Klamath Lake must be maintained under the tribal water right in levels that are arguably weren't even achievable prior to the Link River Dam's construction in 1921. Nevertheless, the department began shutting down surface water rights in response to tribal calls during the spring of 2013. In the fall of 2013, the department contacted some legislators, myself and Representative Whitsitt and others, to let us know that they were going to start conjunctively managing the surface and groundwater and that they had intended then to regulate as many as 240 irrigation wells in the Upper Klamath Basin based on this call from the surface water adjudication in which the well owners were specifically prohibited from participating. The department allegedly based its decision on an attorney general opinion for regional and local groundwater modeling. And they began shutting off irrigation wells in early summer of 2014 and significantly expanded the number of wells that were regulated in 2015. So, In short, many farms and ranches lost their rights to use their surface water in 2013 due to the surface water adjudication. And then they lost the use of their groundwater rights in 2015, all by departmental administrative actions. So, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, should you decide to post a work session, we will be willing to wait. I'm done.
Thank you. I would like to have the opportunity for questions. I would also like to tell people that we have only just now gotten the last amendment back for 1559. I know many of you are here for that one. The decision was made since the Senate has to go back on the floor at 5. And we couldn't do that until 5:30 because of 1 hour notice. But that will be moved to capital construction tomorrow morning. I apologize to those of you who have been waiting patiently for this bill, but as you all know, things can go sideways sometimes at the very end of session. So thank you all for your patience and look forward on tomorrow morning's capital construction. Senator Johnson.
Listening to you speak, Senator Whitsitt, the idea just kept coming to me that anybody can take no for an answer if they think they've had a square shot at a level playing field. And it sounds to me as though you are detailing a litany of administrative adjustments that change the balance. And I also juxtapose my comments against the shrill cry that I've heard in this building from both the R's and the D's about using best available science. And I'm wondering, when an agency takes it upon themselves to change the playing field, is there any opportunity for peer review by other water adjudicatory agencies, other states? Is what Water Resources is doing to achieve an outcome even remotely akin to best science? That's question number one. And question number two, it appears that it may take legislation to rein in their tilting of the table one way or another. Is that a correct assumption to draw from your testimony?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chairs, Senator Johnson. The answer to your first question, in my opinion, is no. More importantly, in the opinion of several different hydrogeology firms who have done well testing, sustained rate pumping tests, and aquifer analysis on some of those wells, they do not believe that either the groundwater modeling, the regional groundwater modeling, or the local modeling on many of these wells has any basis in fact. But we, you know, obviously they're not here to say that. But that is my understanding of it. From the rest of the situation, I think it does require legislation to fix this, because there is enough lack of clarity in the current laws to sort of move the shells around. And I think that it's been established for 50 or 60 years at least how you go about doing a sustained rate pumping test on a well and applying that to a log curve. How you do it, you turn on the pump and you measure the water, and you turn on the pump and you measure it at precise instance all the way down, like for 3 days or 4 days or 5 days. And then you turn the pump off and you measure it all the way back up, and you plot those points on a log graph. And then the people that are a lot smarter than me, like my wife, will look at the log graph and say, you know, okay, this is a normal curve for a depression cone at the well, or if it has a sharp deviation, then likely there's a boundary someplace. If it flattens out, likely it's getting water from another source. But I mean, it's not rocket science. They've done it all the time. They've done it for 50 or 60 years. They've used the same formulas. It is my contention that the Water Resources Department has bypassed all that good science by using a groundwater model that is, to be generous, is not well calibrated.
Just by way of an editorial comment, given my past professional life, I at least have some legitimate claim to theories that involve black helicopters. And I would just suggest, colleagues, that there has been enough evidence of very subtle administrative changes in the state's interpretation of much fundamental water law to give rise to suspicion on the part of some of us that are prone to think this way, that there is an overall executive-level scheme with respect to the management of water. And I would just believe that it is part of our job to bring clarity to that whole scenario for the benefit of Oregonians who may be being deprived of a fundamental right established in law by us changing how the playing field is set in order to shift the burden of proof, and in some cases denying people a water right established in law and certainly history, and by doing so deprive them of any economic value out of managing their land for either crop or animal production. And I think that there is a clarion call for us as legislators to be more vigilant about what all is occurring behind the scenes with respect to the state's interference, for lack of a better word, with some of these fundamental rights attached in history and law to land, whether it's in the Klamath Basin or any place else in our beloved state.
Yeah. Senator Johnson, I agree. Several points. One, a water right, according to the Oregon Supreme Court, is a property right. So, I mean, when you take that ability to use the water, you've taken a property right. As our good co-chair can attribute, in eastern Oregon, land without water is not of much value, and particularly with our land use planning laws, you can't use it for anything else. So if you take the water off of it, you take probably 90-95% of the value is gone. In fact, when they turned off the water to the Klamath Project in 2001, this was done by the Department of Interior. But nonetheless, our local assessor reassessed the land at 1% of its value previously, 99% reduction. And the Department of Revenue, although they kind of howled, ended up supporting it because he had to support him. I mean, it was 99% of the value is the water. So, yes. And finally, on the what this bill is attempting to do is just to reestablish the lines on the playing field and just play by the rules.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to give a quick thanks to our two big co-chairs for allowing us to have this public hearing, and I really appreciate, Senator, you bringing this issue forward. It's been good for us to hear this.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
I might just add a punctuation mark to the co-chair's comments, looking at him and thinking from where he hails and having been out there on more than one occasion with legislative colleagues to show the difference between irrigated ag and non-irrigated ag. And given the role that the co-chair is playing in trying to salvage a piece of ostensibly befouled and abandoned property and turn it into something valuable, our state commitment to try to provide water for irrigated ag, it seems to me as though we're being somewhat selective about how we treat water. We're pumping water into the Umatilla Basin, recognizing the value of water. We're stripping water out of the Klamath Basin for purposes that have not, I think, been fully revealed. And I find the ironic juxtaposition of the state's relationship with those two basins, and I know that's not a proper scientific word, to be irreconcilable. And I have yet to hear a fully articulated water policy that does not involve the taking of private water. And I would welcome hearing that. There's been way too much behind-the-curtain stuff for my tastes, with some desire to regulate water all the way from the headwaters to the ocean. It seems to me that that, at a minimum, ought to be shared with Oregonians if that's a direction that we're headed. And we're certainly spending money in the Umatilla, something I completely support. I think there ought to be a much greater degree of clarity on what we're doing with water policy in this state, and we don't read about it in national journals ex post facto. And I appreciate you raising the issue for this committee.
The water law is a very, very complex and difficult
Would that I had studied water law in law school. I might have found a better way in the world as an adult.
And I'll close with the comment in most of Oregon, I mean, at least two-thirds of the state, the difference between irrigated agriculture and land that has had the water taken off of it is farmland and desert. That's
yeah,
what it is.
Right.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Senator Whitley?
Thank you. No, good. I just want to make sure, Senator, I want to make sure everybody's time.
Just for the purpose of the record, I would hope that Senator Whitsitt and Representative Whitsitt continue to raise this issue. The short session may be too short a period of time for an issue of this degree of complexity. But if we as the legislature are not vigilant in this subject matter, I don't know what we're going to lose via inattention. And I just hope that we have the opportunity to talk about this in the long session, because I believe it's fundamental to the economic opportunity in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Senator. We had two other people, Jerry Nicolescu and Meta Lutzgarden, I hope I pronounced your names correctly, signed up to testify. Both of them have given Julie a note saying that they would prefer not to testify because it's sort of small, but they're happy to answer questions they have submitted or will be submitting, have submitted written testimony. I'm cool doing it whichever way you want, but it sounds as if you guys think it's better to not testify right now. I don't want to take the opportunity away from members of the public.
If I may, ours is on a very minor section of the bill, not related
cool.
to what Senator Whitson.
Then I think we'll just take a pass, and thank you so much for being here and for submitting written testimony. Colleagues, I want to thank all of you. Senator Whitsitt, I'd like to thank you very much, and my apologies to Representative Whitsitt. These things were kind of out of my control. And thanks to all of you who hung in with us. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4012. And as I mentioned, the work session on Senate Bill 1559 is being moved to the Capitol Construction agenda tomorrow morning. So watch for it on that channel at that time. Is there any other business before the committee at this time? If not, I would like to offer my thanks to my co-chair, with whom, as usual, I had an extraordinarily good working relationship. I'd like to thank all the members of our committee. We are blessed on this committee with some really smart, thoughtful, caring people who work really hard and ask important questions and do their homework, and I'm grateful to all of you very much. And if anybody else would like to say anything briefly before we have to boogie, because the Senate has to be back on the floor. Representative Collins.
Thank you. We can't do our jobs without LFO.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Mr. Borden, I'm hoping you're listening,
Julie.
Because and Julie, because you guys are awesome. And Co-Chair Smith and I have worked closely with Mr. Borden for 4 years now and feel ourselves fortunate to do so. Anybody have anything else to say? Okie dokie, folks. I think we are adjourned for the 2016 session. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
And thank you all very, very much.